Welcome to this special edition of Humanism Today, featuring Dr. Eugenie Scott, Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. Posing questions for her will be a panel of participants from the Humanist Union of Madison. I'm your host, Robert Park. Eugenie, perhaps you could start by giving us some background on how the National Center for Science Education came to be.
Well, the National Center for Science Education got its start in the early 90s. Excuse me. Oh, boy. How quickly the time passes. Got its start in the early 80s when there was a lot of legislation being proposed around the country for equal time for creation science and evolution laws, including Wisconsin, by the way. And scientists and teachers didn't like that very much, and so a number of us were very concerned that these laws not be passed. And, of course, there was also a lot of activity promoting creationism at the local school board level. It was really a very active time for the anti-evolutionists. And the National Center for Science Education was formed from these scientists and teachers who were working individually around the country to cope with these problems at the state or local level. Got started, got organized in 1981, was incorporated in 1983, but it really didn't get rolling other than just a newsletter that was circulated to people around the country who were involved in the controversy. Didn't really get going until 1986, when one of the founding members managed to raise some money from private foundations to open an office and hire a director and start some programs. And I applied for that job, and I was hired for the job, and I opened the first national office of NCSC in January of 1987. And I've been doing it ever since.
Did you get involved?
And I haven't solved the problem yet.
Did you get your start in this area with something in Lexington, Kentucky before the formation?
Well, before I became director of NCSC, I was a college professor. I taught physical anthropology at the university level for, I don't know, 11, 12 years, something like that. But I actually got my interest in creation science and the creationist movement as a graduate student back in 1971, about when my professor at the University of Missouri gave me some literature from the creation science people, and I was hooked. I mean, this was the most interesting thing, because here these people were saying that they were doing science, and I was studying to be a scientist, and boy, were we doing stuff different. So I started collecting literature from creation science, and I collected it for a decade. And, you know, some of the times I'd read it when it would come in. I got on the mailing lists of the creationist associations, and much of the time I just would set it aside, or I'd be in a bookstore and I'd see something kind of interesting and I'd buy it. And so, you know, I had a familiarity with the creation science movement. And then when I was teaching at the University of Kentucky, we had one of these community-level controversies where the Citizens for Balanced Teaching of Origins, was their name, came to the Lexington Board of Education to propose that this great new science of creation science be taught. And there even are scientists from California who'd come out and teach our teachers how to teach this. And this was going to be a great, wonderful, cutting-edge bit of science education. And of course, up on campus, we were having a fit, because the last thing we wanted was the Lexington School Board to pass this crazy pseudoscience. So, and I was actually one of the few people in Lexington who actually knew anything about creation science, because I had this whole box of literature I'd been collecting for so many years. So what we ended up doing is the scientists on campus, scientists, philosophers of science, historians, the folks interested in this area got together, and I got out my big box of books and, you know, handed this stack of literature to the biologists and this stack of literature to the physicists and this stack of literature to the geologists and this to the philosophers of science, and, you know, go out and write this stuff up. And basically the campus community ended up analyzing the creationist literature, pointing out what was wrong with it. We produced this big, thick white paper for the Lexington School Board that explained exactly why creation science was not science, its claims were wrong, and it would be a really, really bad idea to teach this to our kids in school. You would think, in a rational world, that that would be sufficient to solve the problem, but that isn't. That was absolutely necessary. I mean, if the science community had not stood up and said, this is not science, we shouldn't do it. The game would be over and there'd be no hope. I mean, because their argument was that this was a valid science, it deserves a place next to evolution in the curriculum, and, you know, if we hadn't been able to counter that, it would have been all over. But we also needed the teachers, because the teachers would be able to get up in those many school board meetings where this issue was debated over the year and a half or so of the controversy. The teachers would get up and they would say, the scientists say this is not good science. Our professional science teacher organizations say that this is not good science. Don't make us teach something that goes totally against our professional standards. That was a very important thing to say. That wouldn't have solved the problem either. That was necessary but not sufficient, just like the scientist input was necessary but not sufficient. The thing that really made the difference in Lexington was the mainstream clergy got together and went to that school board and said, you know, evolution's okay with us mainstream Protestants, with us Catholics and the Jews. Evolution's okay with us, and we want to teach creation our own way on Saturday and Sunday. We don't want you teaching one person's creationism Monday through Friday, and then we have to straighten the kids out on the weekend. And that is what really did it. Now, there was one, you might be going into details about this, it's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, it is.
I remember one school board meeting in Lexington that was a very, very pivotal meeting. And we had, you know, we had a community organization of the scientists, the teachers, the clergy, etc. The organization was called CEASE, which was the Committee for Effective Action in Science Education. You got to have a name if you have a group, right? That's the way it works. So part of our CEASE group, we knew that the members of the Lexington Clergy Association, which was the Lexington Alliance of Religious Leaders, Laurel, L-A-R-L, the Laurel group had signed a petition, and they were going to read it at the school board meeting. So everybody showed up for this meeting because this was going to be a very dramatic moment. Well, we had no idea how dramatic it was going to be. The man who read the petition from Laurel was the senior pastor of the First Baptist Church in Lexington, and a wonderful man. If you ever needed a central casting minister, this is the guy you'd go to. Tall, you know, broad-shouldered, silvery hair. I mean, he was great. Authoritarian voice, great presence. He was just marvelous. And he stood there in all of his imposing presence at the behind the podium at the school board meeting, and he read this very simple statement that said, basically, evolution's okay with us. You know, part of our theology, we recognize that God could have acted through many ways, including through evolution, to produce the wonderful world according to, et cetera. You know, the religious statement. And then, I didn't realize, none of us realized he was going to do this, but he read the names and churches of every single one of those 78 signatories. And with appropriate pauses. So, and I was sitting out in the audience, and I literally heard gasps around the audience, like, that's my pastor. And see, that to me was highly educational, because, and actually it was highly educational for the mainstream clergy, because they found out that a lot of the people who were Episcopalians and Methodists and ECLA Lutherans, etc., didn't realize that they were not creationists. I remember the pastor from Second Presbyterian coming up to me and saying, yeah, we got to do a better job in Sunday school. Because one of his congregation had come up to him and said, you know, Reverend so-and-so, you know, why are you over there with the scientists? Aren't we creationists? And he had to sit him down and explain what Presbyterian theology was with evolution. It's, of course, it's theistic evolution, that God uses evolution to create and so forth. It's not an anti-science position at all. So it was an extremely dramatic moment, and really helped me understand the importance of having the mainstream clergy as a part of these controversies over evolution. So it took several more meetings, a number more months, but finally Every voice had been heard ad nauseum, and the school board was going to vote. Now, Lexington has a little dinky board. It's only five people. We had two school board members whom we knew were solidly forced. We had two school board members whom we knew were hopeless. They were going to vote to try to impose this policy. There was one school board member who was the swing vote. Now, this was the only black person, the only black man on the school board, and he was a Southern Baptist. And on the Friday before the big Monday showdown vote school board meeting, he had been interviewed by the local newspaper, and the paper reported that he had decided to go on retreat this weekend and pray about the decision, which wasn't exactly the sort of thing that gave us a whole lot of confidence that things were going to go our way on Monday. So come Monday, and everybody shows up at the school board meeting, of course, to see what's going on. And the vote is taken, and we have two votes for and two votes again, and Mr. Steele votes against the policy. He voted our way. We were really, really happy. And you know, we'd spent all of this time talking about how creation science was terrible science, and it really wasn't science at all because it required the supernatural intervention and all this sort of stuff. The teachers had gone on and on and on about, don't make us violate our professional standards by making us teach this, you making us choose between our jobs and our, what's that? The clergy had shown up. Of course, you know, the conservative clergy quickly got organized after the mainstream clergy did, and so, you know, we had a clergy standoff there. But we'd had all of this discussion on all of these important issues. When Mr. Steele was asked, why did you vote the way you did? He said, because it would cost too much money.
A capitalist on the school board.
This was also a learning experience for me. It helped me understand that these decisions really are not made on the basis of logic and empirical facts and rationality, et cetera, et cetera. They are made on the basis of votes. School board members are elected, big surprise. And elected officials tend to be looking over their shoulder at who's going to vote next. And so if you can, as we worked very hard to do, try to get lots of people to show up at the school board meeting that clearly support your point of view. They clap very enthusiastically when one of your people speaks and sit there very politely when the other people speak. Don't say a word. Then you can at least create the impression that there's a lot of people who care about your issue, who are on your side, and they're going to be voters, of course. Because the school board members are really kind of, you know, holding their finger in the air to test the wind at all times. And it also helped underscore for me the fact that if you're going to get your policies passed, you have to make them relevant to the community. Now, the Lexington educational community really didn't want to spend any additional money, and they would have had to have had special teacher training. After all, those scientists from California willing to come out and train our teachers weren't going to do it for free. They would have to require new textbooks. They would have to require curriculum changes, things that would have cost money, and the powers that be didn't have the money. They weren't willing to do it. I mean, if we had known better, we could have used that argument from day one. That might have been much more successful. So I learned a lot about community organizing with the Lexington controversy. I had to review a whole lot of science that I wasn't familiar with. I mean, I'm a physical anthropologist. I've never taught thermodynamics in my life, right? But one of the main creationist arguments is the second law of thermodynamics somehow is supposed to refute evolution. So I had to learn about the second law of thermodynamics. So there's all kinds of stuff that happened at that year and a half or so. But we won in Lexington, and it taught me a great deal about the controversy. And so when a number of years later I was looking for a job, I mean, I had left a position at the University of Colorado, and my daughter and I and my husband were living in the San Francisco Bay Area. And, you know, my husband had a good job in the Bay Area, and I, you know, didn't really want to do the migrant worker college professor thing where you work here for a year and here for a year and here for a year. So I was looking around to, you know, what do I do now? What do I do when I grow up? And the job as director of the National Center for Science Education was advertised, and I thought, I can learn how to run a small business. I mean, I know the science, and I know how to deal with the press after my year in Lexington. I know the controversy, and I can probably figure out what the IRS wants me to do to run a small business, to run a nonprofit. So I applied for the job, and they hired me, and I've enjoyed doing this ever since. Mm-hmm. Been the best job I've ever had.
Great. Well, jumping ahead to 2005 and the Dover, Pennsylvania case, the National Center for Science Education played an important role in supporting
that was a very important case. Interestingly enough, NCSC got rolling in, you know, 97 or so, which was the year that the Supreme Court set its decision, Edwards versus Aguilar, that struck down those kinds of equal time for creation science laws that had sort of gotten NCSC started in the first place. But that didn't solve the problem. Just because the Supreme Court says teaching creation science is unconstitutional doesn't mean that the creationists go home. They just reinvent themselves. And one of the ways that they reinvented themselves was to morph into this form of creationism called intelligent design. And as you say, Bob, in 2005, we were helping some citizens in Dover, Pennsylvania, who were struggling with the school board, kind of like Lexington, struggling with the school board that wanted to impose a policy of teaching intelligent design. And there was a long history of anti-evolutionism in Dover. We had records going back to, you know, like 03, where there had been, you know, dust-ups about the teaching of evolution. A student had painted a mural of, you know, the striding hominids, the familiar icon of evolution. And this had been a school project. He was an art student, and he made this nice little, you know, marching hominids thing. It was a big mural, like 15 feet long. And it was in the science classroom. And one of the buildings and grounds people took offense at this and took it out and burned it one weekend, which was a little much. But so there had been these kind of little dust-ups about evolution in the past. So in 2005, the school board had a majority of, or close to a majority of creationists on it, and so they tried to ram through this policy about buying the intelligent design textbook of pandas and people, passing this policy, etc. And the parents in the community fought very hard, fought for a long time, but the board was just recalcitrant. There was no compromise possible. So citizens decided they had no recourse but to sue. And I think that's important for people to know, because nobody wants to go to court, really. Trust me on this one. You don't want to solve these problems with the law. You want to solve these problems with negotiation, with compromise, with, you know, with integrity, obviously. But lawsuits are expensive. They're time-consuming. They're exhausting. They use resources, both human and material, that could certainly be used for better purposes, like maybe educating kids. And, you know, the last thing you want to do is go to court. But the citizens of Dover didn't have any choice. They really had to go to court because the school board was completely uncompromising. So that said, if you're going to go to court with a case, go with a case like Dover. Because Dover was a wonderful case for our side. First of all, you had a school board that said really dumb things publicly. There was a paper trail a mile long of religious statements from the school board member underscoring the fact that they were passing this policy in order to promote religion. Well, that's death when it comes to the First Amendment. I mean, the law is going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. Of course, they fought very, very hard to exclude all of those newspaper articles, and, you know, it was just hearsay, and there was a big fight over that sort of thing. And they claimed that the statements that many, many witnesses said they heard during the school board meetings really were not said. And I mean, you know, they didn't want this paper trail and this oral trail to... somehow or another, the tape recordings of the school board meetings just disappeared. So there were lots of things going on there. And the other thing that made Dover a really good case for us is because the policy in question had two parts. One part was intelligent design, which we knew was pretty vulnerable. I mean, intelligent design also has a paper trail, and there's lots and lots of information there that suggests that indeed intelligent design is a religious idea. And we knew that they wouldn't really argue with it being a religious idea. It's kind of hard not to admit that. I mean, there's just too many books and articles where the major people in intelligent design have admitted the fact that this is, you know, this is a sectarian religious view. But they would argue that it is really cutting-edge science. And, you know, we knew we could attack that. And crossing our fingers, if we had an open-minded judge, you know, that we felt we, you know, if we worked really hard and we had a reasonable judge, we could make that sale. But the second part of the Dover policy was the one that I was really interested in. Because this part of the policy said that the student, that the teachers should be, or that the students should learn the gaps / problems in Darwin's theory. So this, it had not only an ID component, but an anti-evolution component. And this is really the modern anti-evolutionist strategy, to teach the strengths and weaknesses of evolution, or teach the evidence against evolution, or a critical analysis of evolution, which means criticize evolution. Doesn't really mean critical analysis. So there's lots of euphemisms for the strengths and weaknesses kind of idea. But the idea is that a teacher will teach evolution, but then teach all the things that are wrong with it, which from a scientific standpoint aren't there, but it's all basically what the creation science and the intelligent design people are claiming, the old second law of thermodynamics and everything else. So the fact that both of these current creationist strategies were present in the Dover policy made it a really good one for us on the evolution side of things, because we figured that ID was vulnerable, and from a legal standpoint, the evidence against evolution argument is less vulnerable. But if we could tie them together and sync them both, then we could set a precedent that would be extremely useful to us the next school board problem that came along. Especially if it had a smarter school board that didn't leave the paper trail that this one did. So Dover was in many respects a very good case for it. Now that said, you don't leave stuff to chance. And the legal team was the ACLU, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and Pepper Hamilton, which is a large commercial law firm in Philadelphia. And Eric Rothschild, who's a partner in Pepper, is one of my legal advisory committee members, and so that's how Pepper was brought in. So the legal team was those two public interest firms, church-state separation groups, a commercial law firm, and NCSE, because we acted as advisors to the legal team. And we proposed a series we were advisors to the legal team on science and education issues and creationism issues. Obviously, we were not advising them on the law. That's not our expertise. But we do know a lot about this controversy, and we do know a lot about evolution. And so we could advise on pedagogical issues as well. So we recommended a group of expert witnesses and why we thought they would be appropriate given the theory of the case, and some backups in case they weren't available. And the good news is that we got the A-team. The lawyers asked all of the our first recommendations. They were all willing to help us, as we pretty much knew they would, three of them being board members of NCSE, for starters. But so we got a wonderful group of expert witnesses. We really did. Very articulate men and women. Who could make the case that intelligent design was not a cutting-edge new science that students should be exposed to. It wasn't science at all. It violated all the rules of science that we use today in the 21st century, the primary component of which is that to be science, it has to be testable and it has to be natural. And intelligent design is neither. They propose no testable hypotheses whatsoever, and ultimately they're dealing with a supernatural intelligent agent who produces complicated things. So we had very good expert witnesses who could make that statement that intelligent design was not science. And also that the very few specific claims that it made, like irreducible complexity and, you know, that sort of thing, the bacteria flagellum or blood clotting system, immune system, these other points that they claim cannot be explained through natural causes, they were simply wrong. So the question that the Dover School Board, the point the Dover School Board had to make was that intelligent design was cutting-edge science because it was this, you know, this valid and accurate new field, and that was the secular reason for teaching it. That, yes, maybe there were some religious components to it, but you could just set those aside because as a valid science, there was a secular reason to teach it, and that was where they had to craft their case. And, of course, we had to attack that by showing that it wasn't science and any fact claims it made were wrong. Hence, what possible secular reason could there be for teaching it, since it, you know, didn't cut the mustard across the board? So that pretty much was a big component of what we helped them with. And then, obviously, there were other parts of the case as well, like the, you know, the venality of the school board members who lied on the stand, which ordinarily is not considered a good thing by judges. So the good news is that this Republican judge, who was a George Bush appointee and a practicing Lutheran, but very, and non-scientist, had not taken a science class since college, and, you know, is a educated man and everything, but didn't have any special expertise or interest in science for all of that. But this, you know, judge who was, and he'd never heard of intelligent design, hadn't a clue what it was, so he learned about it from the trial. And obviously he must have done some reading himself as well. But this judge listened to all the evidence and concluded that intelligent design was not science, its claims were erroneous, there was no secular reason for teaching it, and the policy had to go. We were very happy when this happened. But, you know, one of the things that I take home from the Dover experience is, I should say that NCSE, over the 20 years or so that we've been around, has advised legal teams in the past. You know, we've advised, more than one. But never have we been involved from day one in a really big trial. And I had no idea what a campaign a big trial is. I mean, we prepared for this for almost a year. It was like 11 months of preparation, planning the case, writing the initial complaint, choosing the expert witnesses, assisting them with their witness statements, which the lawyers couldn't do, but we could do because we weren't the lawyers. Preparing them for their depositions, helping the lawyers understand the kinds of questions they should ask for the other side's expert witnesses. I mean, people, you know, a trial is like an iceberg. It's like an iceberg that has a very heavy weight on it because most of an iceberg, as everybody knows, is underneath the water and only a small part is up above. But with a trial, it's even more. So much more is underwater that, you know, the public just doesn't see the amount of work that goes into what actually takes place during those 6 weeks of being on the stand. So when the 6 weeks of actual trial activity took place, it was, you know, it was sort of like seeing a play be put on that you'd been rehearsing and practicing and changing the script on for months and months and months. It was a very exciting experience. On the last day of the trial, the opposing lawyers, who, by the way, were very professional, and both teams of lawyers behaved very well to each other. You know, they were very cordial. They were very professional. They extended courtesies to one another and so forth. And, you know, everything was very properly done. No name calling. It was, you know, a very civilized trial, which I'm from Wisconsin, so of course I want people to be civilized. What do you expect? one of the opposing attorneys team members, on the last day of the trial, made a little joke, which kind of was really surprising because he was a real, you know, kind of a, not exactly a jocular person, shall we say. But he said to the judge, he said, Your Honor, I noticed that today is the 40th day of the trial, which makes tonight, of course, the 40th night. He said, and he wanted to know if the judge had any comment on that. And the judge, who is very quick, we like the judge a lot. The judge said, well, Mr. So-and-so, that is a very interesting observation, but it was not by design. And with that, there was a big laugh from the audience. Court is adjourned. And if you want to read that wonderful last line or anything else from the transcript of the court, if you go to ncseweb.org, which is our website, there's a link, but it'd be hard to find. Go to ncseweb.org, and we have a nice little search routine. Search for Kitzmiller versus Dover, and you'll get our page on Kitzmiller, which has not only the transcripts from the whole trial, but also all the witness statements from both sides, all the court documents. It's a complete record of everything that happened in Kitzmiller versus Dover. It's a wonderful resource for anybody wanting to know more about this really very interesting trial.
One of the things I remember from the trial that I was particularly interested in was the different drafts of the about Candace and people. Do you want to tell how the connection with creation science was established?
Oh, that was wonderful. The Book of Pandas and People was the very first publication to use the phrase intelligent design in its modern sense of referring to this new creationist movement. And it was published in 1989. And of course, we, reviewed it then, and we've been following and working with and coping with the silly book ever since. And so because Pandas and People was a book that was proposed for use in Dover, all this research came back again. So we were able to dig out all the things that we had said about it and understandings of it from years back. But we also had a lot of information on the writing of the book in our archives. And I sent one of my colleagues back to the archives to look in some of the old creationist publications, the Bible Science Newsletter, of which we have almost a complete run in our archives, and the Students for Origins Research Newsletter, and these other kinds of things. Go back and look through this stuff and see if there's any mention of pandas and people, because, of course, our goal was to tie intelligent design to creation science, because creation science had already been judged by the Supreme Court to be unconstitutional. So if we could tie intelligent design to creation science, we win right there. And, of course, one of the ways of tying it would be to find references to it in the creationist literature and, favorable and so forth. So one of my coworkers found an old Students for Origins Research newsletter from 1981. They had a little article in it, just a little short 3-inch article, little tiny piece. We're lucky she found it, right? And this article said that John Buell from the Foundation for Thought and Ethics was preparing a new creation science textbook. A creation biology textbook. We thought, that's interesting, because John Buell and the Foundation for Thought and Ethics, FTE, was the publisher of Pandas and People. And this was 1981, and of course Pandas wasn't published until 89, but gee, I wonder if this could be the beginning, of paleo pandas, so to speak. So my colleague Nick Motzke, with that as a clue and some other references that we found in the creationist literature about, pandas and people having been begun very early in the 80s, wrote a nice memo to the lawyers. Nick was great. He wrote lots of memos to the lawyers. He was, they have praised him publicly for all the wonderful help he gave them. Nick was marvelous, a really good colleague. But Nick wrote this memo to the lawyers saying, there's evidence that maybe Pandas and People started out as a creationist biology book intended to be a, you know, an equal time for creation science book, because of course 1981, that was well before the Supreme Court decision in 1987, right? So, you know, they could use that sort of language back there. I wonder if there are any early manuscripts around. By that afternoon, the lawyers had decided to subpoena any manuscripts at FTE of the early versions of Pandas and People. And within a day or so, they had sent that subpoena off.
FTE, Foundation for Thought and Ethics.
Correct. The Foundation for Thought and Ethics was the publisher of Pandas and People. It's a ministry in Dallas, Texas, that's run by John Buell. And I'd have loved to have been a fly on that wall when that subpoena came in, because they must have realized, you know, this is not a good thing for our side of the case. And, of course, they countersued, and it was a big fight, but we got the manuscripts. And, you know, I've said this before, and I always try to say this publicly, it is to FTE's credit that they behaved honestly and ethically and didn't just find a shredder someplace. I mean, they did cough up the... I mean, it would have been very bad to do so, but worse things have been done, right? And they behaved very ethically and honestly, and I respect them for that. So the manuscripts showed up, and of course the lawyers recorded them and stamped them and sent them to us, naturally. We scanned them and did OCR on them and did comparisons, and yes, this was a progression of manuscripts. It was very easy to show by text analysis that this was, you know, evolutionary stages of the same book culminating in the of Pandas and People. But the early manuscripts had very creationist titles, like Biology and Creation, and the next, which was like 86 or something, and then the next one was Creation Biology, and the next one was Creation and Origins. Or, you know, they were all these really creationist-sounding titles. And then in 1987, they changed the name to Of Pandas and People. And there were two 1987 manuscripts, which we will very cleverly call A and B. And we could tell by text comparison which was the earlier of the two 1987 manuscripts. And then there was Pandas and People in the first edition and second edition. That's fine. So one of the first things we did is one of my guys, Wesley Ellsbury, who's a programmer and, you know, really good information kind of guy, wrote some algorithms, wrote some scripts where he did 10-point and 5-point word counts and was able to compare the manuscripts two by two for how similar they were. And being a good empiricist, he, of course, had an outgroup. He had Moby Dick. So he would, you know, because some 5-word phrases are likely to show up in any book, and so you don't want to count those as hits, right? So if you're really doing a manuscript comparison, you have to, you know, do it right. And he did it right. And One of the things that we did was we counted the number of times the word creationism, creationist, some, you know, suffix associated with creation is, how many times those occurred over the various manuscripts, how many times the phrase intelligent design occurred over the various manuscripts. And a very interesting thing was found. That was that in the early creationist manuscripts, you never really found the phrase intelligent design. The word design cropped up from time to time, but not intelligent design, right? And the word creationism was all over the place. Creationism, creationists, all over the place. In 1987, a very interesting thing happened. The first manuscript in 1987 was just like the early creationist books, lots of references to creationism, nothing in terms of intelligent design. The second manuscript in 87 reversed that. All of a sudden, no references to creationism, everything was intelligent design. How curious. And of course, if you have been listening, boys and girls, 1987 was a very important year, because that's when the Supreme Court struck down creation science as a being legal to teach in the schools. So it certainly would be a reasonable hypothesis that when the Supreme Court decision came down, the makers of Pandas and People just went through and replaced every incident of creationism with intelligent design. And we tested it, being good empiricists, right? The next thing we did was we found a passage where in the early manuscripts it said something along the lines of creationism is the idea that an intelligent creator created things in their present form, fish with fins and scales, birds with feathers, beaks and wings, etc. And that statement occurred in all the early versions and in the first 1987 version. In the second 1987 version, all of a sudden it said, intelligent design says that, you know, creatures were created in their present form by an intelligent agent. Fish with fins and scales, birds with feathers, beaks and wings, etc., etc. We were going around the office giggling about fish with fins and scales because we just had them dead to rights. I mean, it was so obvious that they had just substituted the word intelligent design for the word creationism. I mean, dead to rights. And of course, we brought that into the court. And actually, Nick Motzke once again exhibited his value to the lawyers. Nick happens to be a really good computer user. He has a master's degree in physical geography, which is a very technological field. They do a lot of GPS, they do a lot of mapping, they do a lot of graphing. He's really good with data presentation, right? And so the night before the trial, he was just kind of noodling around with some of these numbers, and he came up with this really great graph that literally showed the lines crossing. And he brought it into the lawyers the next morning and said, you know, think you can use this? And they took one look at it and they said, oh, yeah. And this was a very highly technological trial, by the way. The Pepper Hamilton people spent a lot of money hiring a graphics a design firm that specializes in a graphical presentation in courts. Who knew such a specialty existed? I'm ignorant about such things. But they hired this company. And so we had our own computer guy with his three Macs and his big screen and the whole works. And basically they, you know, they gave him the graphic that Nick had prepared, and he scanned it. He made it into a lovely little slide that they took into the court that day and showed to the judge. And the judge, you know, I got to tell you about the judge. The judge was, Judge Jones was a fascinating character. I was sitting right behind the lawyers on the plaintiff's side, and I was probably no more than 20 feet away from this guy. I mean, you know, it's a small courtroom. And so, and I was watching him very carefully, of course. And Judge Jones, poker face. Talk about playing your cards close to your chest. I mean, I could not figure out, he just didn't respond to things, you know? Somebody would say something, and I'd think, oh boy, that's a real zinger, and he'd just be sitting there with his poker face, and, okay, didn't he get it? Well, that was such a great line. How come he didn't? And occasionally he would, you know, he would make little asides or little quips. I mean, he was, you know, the situation was fairly tense. And so he would occasionally make little jokes to kind of, you know, so it wasn't that he was just an automaton or anything like that. But as far as reacting to the different points that the lawyers brought up, he was, by the way, incredibly fair. If either of the legal teams objected to somebody's testimony, he would, you know, hear the objection. And most of the time he would overrule the objection and he would say, well, you know, this is a bench trial. If it turns out that the testimony is irrelevant, I'll disallow it. You know, basically the idea that he being a judge, he's better able to do that than if this were done in front of a jury. And that's a very legitimate thing. And it seemed to me, and it seemed actually to both legal teams, that he was very even-handed about this, that he didn't let one side get by with more than another. You know, he basically wanted them to give him every bit of information they could. So objections in general were overruled unless they were really, you know, sensible, and then they were retained. But so, you know, there was tons of information coming into this guy. But he was very noncommittal as far as responding or reacting to what he was hearing. At least I couldn't read him at all. Well, we showed this slide where the, you know, the intelligent is the creationism line is in the top, and then it plummets in 1987, and the intelligent design line is way down near the x-axis, and then it shoots way up in 1987, and we put that up there, and I think Michael Behe was the first poor soul that had to cope with this slide, and I saw one eyebrow go up on the judge, and I almost stood up and said, yes. It was such a victory to see it. And I thought, oh, yes, he got it, he got it. Hurrah. And so that, as well as a great deal of other information, managed to convince the judge. But probably the most wonderful little, you know, archaeological item that we pulled out of those past manuscripts was actually our expert witness, Barbara Forrest. It was her discovery. That poor woman went through page after page after every single page of these documents. I mean, she, you know, there were like seven manuscripts, and I swear she must have read every single page of every one. She was just surrounded by paper. And she came across a missing link, as it were, where illustrating not only the creationist roots of intelligent design, but the hazards of block and paste, because they had taken the, you know, what was the phrase? You know, creation proponents, and had, you know, blocked that out and pasted in intelligent design. But they hadn't done it quite as tidily as they should have, and so the word they ended up with was see intelligent designists. I'm sorry. See design proponentsists. That's what it was. Sorry. Design proponentsists. So, you know, design proponents was being substituted for creation scientists. But not as tidily as it should have been. And, you know, we've all been there. You know, we have all blocked and pasted incorrectly, so we can have sympathy for them. But, I mean, and we were on the floor when we saw that, because that was just so hysterical. But we didn't bring that into the case, quite honestly, because we had already piled so much on pandas and people that we, you know, the lawyers concluded that that would just be overkill, you know, to bring the k-design proponentsist. But if you were to Google k-design proponentsists, you will find websites, anti-creationist websites, of course, all over the country, you know, poking fun at these guys by referring to them as k-design proponentsists.